Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
We've had enough conversations on this show about the quirks of the human mind to know that very few of our decisions are strictly rational. When we're choosing between similar options, paying attention to the way we feel can actually help us arrive at a decision. So it is worth stepping back and talking about the extent to which emotion is playing a role in our thinking about the candidates and the issues in the 2016 presidential primary race. This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. With the Iowa caucuses just a week away, NPR and public radio stations around the country are launching a national conversation about how emotion and anxiety are motivating voters this year. KERA is participating in this nationally coordinated event with a look at what North Texans are thinking. Are our feelings revealing what we really want and need this year, or obscuring important facts about issues and candidates? We've invited two political scientists today to talk about how voters are feeling and how candidates are playing to those emotions. Rebecca Dean is Associate Professor of Political Science and Department Chair and Distinguished Teaching Professor at the University of Texas at Arlington. James Riddlesberger is Professor of Political Science at Texas Christian University. And of course, we really want to hear how Think listeners are feeling about the issues this election season. Your comments could end up in an NPR story about the current emotional climate. Call us at 800-933-5372. Or email think at kera.org. Rebecca, Jim, welcome both of you back to Think.
Thank you for inviting me.
Thanks for having us.
Is this, it feels to me like a very unusual year. Is it fair to say it's been a more emotional year in terms of the way people are approaching these elections?
Oh, I don't think there's any question. You know, when we were on last here, I think both Rebecca and I were kind of confident in saying that Donald Trump had reached his zenith and would disappear. And of course, he has not. And I think you've hit on really the theme why. And that is that he is resonating with the mood of at least a portion of the American public who are angry about the way things are in the world. I kind of jokingly say that they wish for a world that never was to return. And I think there's some truth to that. And I think Trump does talk to that theme. And it brings to mind our job, if we're analyzing these elections, is not necessarily just to judge the quality of the candidates, but also to look at how the people are reacting to the candidates. It's as if in preparation for the Super Bowl, we're not looking at the quality of the teams, but rather how the crowd is going to react to the teams. Mm-hmm. And that's a very difficult thing to do.
Yeah, I totally agree. That's a great analogy, Jim. So as a little bit of context to this broader conversation, Pew had a great report out at the end of last year about voter opinions and just the mood of the public. And I think that both the Trump phenomenon as well as the Bernie Sanders phenomenon taps into the sense of dissatisfaction. On the left, it's dissatisfaction that the Obama administration didn't bring the coming of these progressive positions that so many of them hold. And then, of course, on the Republican side, the frustration and very strong feelings against President Obama and how Trump is tapping into that.
What's interesting is that this country has been worse off, and in recent history it's been worse off. You know, we are no longer as actively engaged in war. The economy has come back somewhat. It would seem that things are improving, including the things that people are especially upset about this time around.
And it's a disconnect between the facts and perception. So one thing that's really interesting is the state of the economy, right? So even though in terms of GDP, unemployment numbers, whatever objective measure you want to take, the economy might not be doing as poorly as the perception, the sense that, well, my job maybe is in jeopardy, or my wages have stagnated, or my brother-in-law is about to be laid off. And that's, I think, part of what Trump is tapping into.
I agree completely. And to make it even kind of broader than that, I mean, I think there's uncertainty about the economy because there's uncertainty in the world. We no longer live in an economy that is defined in North Texas or in the United States. In fact, what happens in China predicts how our stock market's going to do, for example, on any day. And I think people are frustrated with the fact that they really have no security about what the economy is going to look like tomorrow, next week, or next year.
So it feels beyond our control.
That's right.
We want to know what you think. We're taking calls now at 1-800-933-5372. Questions that I'd like to talk about are, do you feel like you're part of the middle class, and have you always been? How confident do you feel that you can move up economically in the United States today as long as you work hard and follow the rules? As we wait for those calls to come in, I'm curious what challenges a shrinking middle class, which has been documented in America, we have more at the bottom and a few more at the top, what challenges does that shrinking middle class present to politicians trying to make a case for why they should lead the country?
Well, I think those middle class values, the ability to buy a home, the ability to have only one person working full time in a family, those things have disappeared in many parts of the middle class. And a lot of people are no longer able to buy, even with low interest rates, not able to buy homes. And the cost of homes is going up so rapidly. And then, you know, every family has to have two full-time employed parents or more than full-time employed parents to get by. And I think the other reaction is to the fact that we have this massively growing income of a very, very small percentage of people in the United States. And I think there's resentment about that as well.
And again, I come back to both Trump and to Sanders. Trump's biggest support is from the South up through Appalachia, and then up through the post-industrial Northeast. And on Sanders' side, he's tapping into explicitly class distinctions and differences in dissatisfaction.
I was really interested in the Pew Research about the shrinking middle class that came out last month, December of 2015. Defined for a three-person household, the middle income range is between 42,000. This is a three-person household, 42,000 and $126,000. That's all called middle income. And yet, I would imagine if you feel at the bottom of that, you feel nowhere near as secure as you would at the top of that range. It's a huge difference.
And we know that socioeconomic status tracks so much with political engagement and political participation more generally, that the more resources you have, whether that's monetary or information, the more likely you are not only to vote, but to engage in your community in other sorts of ways.
And, of course, for many of these people, it is a measure of dissatisfaction with the government. And dissatisfaction can lead to two kinds of behaviors. One is angry participation in politics, and the other one is choosing not to participate at all. And of course, in the United States, you know, in Texas, we had 29% turnout in the 2014 elections. So a lot of Americans have just opted out of the political process, and that also has huge impact.
This is one big difference, I think, between the parties. There's this question about whether voters would prefer to see politicians address the gap between the ultra wealthy and everybody else, the, you know, income disequilibrium, or should we focus on the needs of the people at the very bottom and making sure that everyone can have at least, you know, a sort of baseline of decent living?
Yeah, I think that's a fair point, and I do believe that obviously the Bernie Sanders wing of the Democratic Party, but also to some extent Hillary Clinton, want to focus on bringing that floor up so that we don't have people, as many people, in poverty. And of course, that's part of what the universality movement in healthcare was. And then the Republican Party, I think, is looking at those core values that no longer seem to matter as much as they used to for middle class families.
If you go back to the Pew report that was released in November, the one I referenced earlier, they have this interesting measure of what is it that you think government ought to play a role in? Do you think that government's doing a good job in that? And then they stratify that by both party and engagement. And so for both political parties, but especially among Republicans, the people who are the least engaged, so not likely to pay attention, not likely to vote, those are the ones who, as compared with their engaged fellow partisans, are more likely to think there is a role for government in addressing poverty and that government's not doing a good job about it.
Is it possible to vilify, you know, Washington in air quotes and still have trust in the government as a whole? Or are those two things, you know, functionally the same for most people?
It's a double-edged sword. Obviously, it's a double-edged sword. I think we've seen it in presidential leadership for years and years, that the presidents try to, on the one hand, talk about how poorly Washington makes decisions, and then on the other hand, give more responsibility to the government to carry out some of those important functions that we all kind of demand of government.
And trust is at an all-time low right now, and it's an all-time low that goes all the way back to 2007.
Let's go to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. We have Rhonda on the line in Murphy. Hi, Rhonda.
Yes, hi. Good morning. I have a question in terms of the magic that some of the candidates are perhaps expecting when they're elected president. It just seems to me that over the last number of years, there's been a disrespect for the current president and therefore, in my opinion, a disrespect for the office of the president. And I'm just not sure how they're anticipating writing that particular attitude once they're elected, because it seems like there's just been so much negativity. And also, in particularly for Mr. Trump, you know, when he stands up and he says that he can shoot someone in the streets of New York and no one, he would not lose support, I just found that so frightening, because, in fact, that was said just a few days ago, and if the polls are correct, he doesn't seem to have lost any support. And I'm just concerned about that as a citizen, that we as voters are still supporting someone who talks about himself being a violent person when there's hardly a day that goes by in our country where someone is not, you know, killed with a firearm. And I'm just afraid for just being out and about in the community that I even live in, that someone could possibly be supporting him and thinking that this is an okay person to accept for the president of the United States. To me, it's a very frightening time. And I'm just looking for you all to help someone like me, just a regular, everyday person, feel that we've not, as voters, gone off the deep end, if I could say.
Thanks for your call, Rhonda. Have voters gone off the deep end?
Well, of course, we don't know how voters are going to behave yet, because we're a week from the very first caucuses, and that's not just voting. Caucuses require the investment of an entire evening in a process, and so it won't be until 2 weeks from today that we actually see the first voting. And Iowa and New Hampshire, of course, are very, very atypical American states, even at that. So I think we are several weeks from understanding how the voters are going to behave in this. But obviously, Mr. Trump is a unique candidate in so many ways. But one way is that he understands that part of his job and his technique, which is kind of the anti-presidential candidate technique, is to have a headline a day. And so he says outrageous things every day, and he says them quite intentionally because he knows that that will make headlines. Not so much because they have anything to do with his position on an issue. In effect, he's not proposing shooting someone on the streets of New York. What he's trying to do is make headlines because he knows coverage is priceless. And so I hope that he's certainly not proposing that. On the other hand, some of the things that he has proposed, I think, do have legs. So, for example, saying that we're not going to allow any Muslims to immigrate into the United States, or somehow that the people immigrating from the South into the United States are bad people, in specifically rapists, among other things. So some of those things do have consequences, but they have had the intended effect of keeping him in the news every day.
I think one of the things, Rhonda, that your comment really speaks to is this notion of fear, whether it's voters who are fearful of what a President Trump administration might look like, or whether it's the kind of fear among the Republican electorate that Trump himself is tapping into. It's interesting, again, that same Pew Research pointed to folks who feel as if their side is, and I say this in air quotes, not winning, that those are the very same people who are the angriest, and those are the very same people who Trump is calling on. So when he says outlandish things, when you listen to him and his comments don't follow the normal trajectory of a speech, from the perspective of academics, you know, who like linearity, they're not that. And he's not talking to us. It's not designed to appeal on an intellectual basis. It's designed to appeal on an emotional one.
We're speaking this hour with political scientist Rebecca Dean of the University of Texas at Arlington and James Riddlesberger of TCU. If you would like to join the conversation, call 1-800-933-5372. After the break, we'll be talking about things like national security. We'll be talking about immigration and demographic changes in the country. Lots of ways for you to weigh in. You can also email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter @ChrisBoydThink.
Thank you.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Spring registration is now open with courses in art, architecture, literature, and languages, as well as professional certificates and test preparation. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
My name is Rebecca Stutheit, and I'm from Saginaw, Texas. As a college student, I think a lot about like student loans and how I'm going to pay that back. My dad was laid off when I was in third grade and didn't have another job until I was a senior in high school. And so because of that, we struggled financially a lot. And I always just noticed the like differences between families who maybe had a little bit more versus my family. And then again, like families who had a little bit less.
My name is Ruben Mancha. I'm from San Antonio, Texas. I'm really passionate about the education for most Texans and those around the United States. Coming out of high school, I feel like we're not getting an education that's affordable to every high school graduate. And I feel it's kind of biased. Not everyone has access to it. So what I would love to see is more access to, you know, maybe community colleges, more access through scholarships and other maybe high school programs that start out with early education. And we'll probably get a lot more people in college as the years go by.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. You just heard Rebecca Stutheit from Saginaw and Ruben Mancha from San Antonio telling our intern Tori Whitley about issues that are important to them in this election cycle. We're speaking this hour with James Riddlesberger of Texas Christian University and Rebecca Dean of the University of Texas at Arlington, both political scientists. If you would like to join our conversation, talk about what you're emotional about this election season, we would love to hear from you at 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org. How does the sense that we are vulnerable to terrorism affect the way Americans make choices on Election Day? It seemed as if people were feeling a bit safer, and then Paris happened. And although there have been similar, even larger attacks in other parts of the world, somehow when it's Europe, I think Americans feel a particular connection.
And there's a real irony. And, of course, San Bernardino followed thereupon as well. I think it's interesting because Americans are so concerned about terrorism, as in Middle Eastern terrorism, but not nearly so much about gun violence, for example, in the United States, which is by a factor of several dozen more risky for the average American. And so it does point to a fear. It points to a fear of the unknown because it comes at any time. In fact, the lesson of the United States since 2001 has been success in both the Bush and the Obama administration. There have been so few terrorist attacks, and the ones that have happened have affected so few people. I think 310 people have died in terrorism in the United States in the last 15 years now, that you would think it was not that big an issue. But it does point to the fact that people feel like they don't have control over their environment anymore. And the fear of the unknown is real, and terrorism is its most important way of manifesting itself.
And as you make the connection to this particular election cycle, it's important to remember how early it is and how much time there is between now and the general election in November in terms of things that can happen to which the candidates will have to respond. And I think the big unknown question, especially in the Republican side, is if there are important events, whether or not they're terrorist related or otherwise, between now and when the nomination gets sewn up, how the candidates react to that.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to Zach in Little Elm. Hi, Zach.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yes. What's on your mind?
Yeah. So I see a lot of parallels between the way that Trump talks about the country and the way that Obama talked about the country during his 2008 presidential bid, especially during the primary to overcome Hillary. Specifically in regards to a lot of the way that he talks about change, and, you know, the platform is very different. But I was wondering what you thought about sort of what that means for rhetoric in general during the presidential year, and, you know, now that it's sort of been run in both parties, what does that mean for the future of presidential politics?
Oh, change is always an issue. Of course, in every presidential election, the candidates are running against the incumbent president. And so one of the reasons that there tends to be a switch from one party to the other every 8 years is that it's easy to make a case against the current president if you are of the opposite party, while it's more difficult if you're within the same party. And that is a thing that happens in the United States all the time. So President Clinton ran on change. John Kennedy ran on change. So this is a continuing thought in the United States. And the question now becomes, how do you package that into a campaign rhetoric that sells your candidate? And one of the things that's most interesting about Donald Trump is that he's running an anti-presidential candidate campaign in some ways, in the sense that he is unscripted. He's not disciplined. He doesn't have a focused message. And that, of course, flies in the face of everything we thought we knew about presidential candidates since at least Ronald Reagan.
And this also brings to mind, you mentioned President Clinton, then Governor Clinton's first campaign. What's interesting about this is if you compare 2008 to now in terms of Secretary of State Clinton's, then Senator Clinton, sort of had the unfortunate luck to be in a year of change when she was very much part of, you know, a family name that was very recognizable and had been in the Senate and so forth, and couldn't stand up to Obama's seemingly more authentic call for change. And at the same time, in this cycle, among the Republicans, all of the folks that we thought at the beginning who would do well, the establishment figures, are clamoring to win out at fourth.
Primary contests always split parties up a little bit because people will line up behind one candidate or another. And there's been a really interesting sort of larger, I think, than predicted split in the Democratic Party between people who think that Bernie Sanders is the way to go and people who are drawn to Hillary Clinton. On the other hand, within the GOP, it seems that there's a shift between establishment Republicans and sort of the Tea Party factions and different things that feels deeper. That rift feels deeper than it does on the Democratic side.
Yeah. I honestly think that the Democratic campaign will spin out fairly quickly. Remember, again, that Iowa and New Hampshire are very white states. They're very middle-class states and upper-middle-class. In other words, they don't have the typical Democratic demographics in them. And so the contests there are very different than they will be, for example, in South Carolina and Nevada, and then moving on into Super Tuesday.
And let me interrupt. Does that mean they don't mean as much as we say they mean in the media by paying so much attention to them?
I think that's particularly true in the Democratic Party, mm-hmm. and particularly this year. But in the Republican Party, I think that's even more complex than what you portray, because I think it's a three-way split. I think you have the establishment kind of traditional Wall Street Republicans on the one hand. You have the Tea Partiers represented really by Ted Cruz on the other hand. And then you have the angry shouting masses represented by Donald Trump that have never really been part of a coalition anymore. And it's going to be interesting to see if he can actually transform that into a political action item. And I don't think we know that yet.
I agree completely, Jim. On the Republican side, it's just so complex. In preparation for today, I was doing a little reading to see what my colleagues had to say about the factors on which the Republican Party is split. And they talk about ideology, of course. And then they also talk about religion, but not in terms of Protestant and Catholic or Christian and non-Christian, but evangelical and not evangelical. And then also class. So there have been a variety of different analogies, the four faces of the Republican Party, or the wings, or, you know, the establishment track versus other tracks. But I guess the bottom line is it's very complicated in the Republican side.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to Sandy in Frisco. Hi, Sandy. All right, we will move on from Sandy, and this time we'll speak with Ken in Fort Worth. Hi, Ken.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call, Chris. I was wondering, when all these national polls are taken that everyone gets so excited about, do they ever say, what do you think about how Congress has worked and what do you think about how the president has worked? Two different questions. Instead of saying Washington, and then no one realizes that there can be a fight between what's going on in Congress and what the president says.
Thanks for your call, Ken. I think there are all different kinds of polls, but my guests are much more familiar with the nuances of them than I am. So.
Yeah, those questions are usually asked. Unfortunately, the Congress question is always a nonspecific one, which is, you know, how do you think Congress is doing, instead of asking about how your member of Congress is doing? And those are very different questions. And so it's really easy to be mad at Congress, since all but three members of Congress don't represent me in Congress. And therefore, they tend to have a much lower public support than does the presidency. Congress is running around 15% confidence level right now. The Republican Party is doing less well in Congress than the Democrats are, probably because they're in control. And so Congress is actually a very, very easy whipping boy. But we also know that more than 95% of the people who run for re-election this year in Congress will be re-elected. So there's a real disparity always between the way people feel about Congress as a institution and how they feel about their member of Congress. President Obama is running right at 50-50. I think he's a little below water right now in terms of his public support. But we see him at 44-45% support, which is actually pretty good compared to, for example, where President Bush was 8 years ago at this point.
Right. So what's interesting about that is exactly what you say. So at the beginning of the calendar year, President Obama was at 46%. If you compare that to George W. Bush at the same time going into his last year of his presidency, it was at 31%. And then for some context, Ronald Reagan was at 50 and President Clinton was at 56. So though we hear, especially when we're so tuned into the Republican rhetoric, because that's a very interesting race to us right now, so you hear a lot of anti-Obama, a lot of rhetoric against the president, his disapproval numbers are about par with his predecessors.
Is it your sense that the emotions driving people to be more engaged this year than they maybe have been in the past, are they mostly negative emotions? Is there a candidate that people are embracing because they feel inspired on either side?
We're on a 50-year downward trend in terms of positive participation in the United States. It really hasn't been since 1968 that we had a majority of Americans participating in politics because they thought that the person they wanted to vote for was going to do good things, but rather they've voted defensively. And so a vast majority of Americans now do tend to vote more negatively than they do positively these days. Who is it that we're most scared of?
And the ones who vote positively are a small percentage. And so what happens is you have an electorate that's factionalized and fractured. So I would say that Bernie Sanders elicits that kind of positive support, but to a small percentage of the Democratic electorate. Ted Cruz elicits a similarly excited response, but again, to a small percentage of the Republican electorate. So if you look at the pie as a whole, there's lots of itty-bitty pieces there.
And the public is so polarized right now. And that polarization, we used to think that the public was probably fairly closely divided, but still agreed on most of the fundamentals in terms of what they wanted out of government. What's become apparent over the last 5 to 6 years is that the public is, in fact, very deeply divided and has different visions of what the United States should look like. And that makes it, of course, doubly difficult to govern once you're elected.
When you talk about what the United States should look like, and I know that you're not referring to demographics here, but it is an issue for a lot of people. Many people feel have observed changes in the way America looks. You know, America's a more diverse place than it was. Certainly if you live in urban areas, but even more suburban and rural areas look a lot more diverse than they once did. Some people are probably delighted by this, and some people seem to be concerned about it.
There's so many things you just put in there. I mean, the big divide in the United States, of course, now is no longer regional politics. It's really politics between urban and non-urban areas. And the Democrats dominate almost every city in the United States. I mean, Fort Worth is one of the largest cities in the United States that's not a Democratic city. Every other city in Texas and across the country that has 750,000 people in it is a Democratic-leaning city, whereas suburban areas and rural areas are much more likely to be Republican. The other thing is I think age makes a huge difference. So when we look at the people who are supporting Donald Trump, for example, he tends to get a lot of support from white men over the age of 50, people for whom change is coming rapidly and in ways that they're not processing very well. And some of the themes that he talks about, I think, appeals to people who would like to see things be more the way they used to be.
I totally agree. And especially when you connect this to immigration and the way that immigration has been spoken about in the Republican Party, if you think about even before all of the folks who are currently running announced, there was great hue and cry over, oh my goodness, will Rubio's position on immigration, will that be problematic for him in the Republican electorate?
As the son of immigrant parents.
Exactly, exactly. And so what's interesting is again, Pew has done polling on this, whether or not folks see immigrants as a strength or as a burden. And the reaction to that is incredibly influenced by partisanship. And so Democrats and Democratic leaners are much more likely to see them as a strength, and Republicans are much more likely to see them as a burden.
If you're listening to this conversation and you have thoughts on this, we would love to know how you feel about the demographic changes in the country, whether they are affecting the choices that you expect to make as the election of 2016 draws just a bit closer. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. Let's go now to Rex in Louisville. Hi, Rex.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
One of the things I found very interesting is that Donald Trump's campaign slogan seems to have become Make America Great Again, which of course carries the implication that America is currently not great. And it seems to me that a lot of the people who fall into his camp are the same sort of people where if you were to, you know, approach them on the street and suggest that America was anything other than the greatest country in the world, would probably be very upset with you for having that. And I just sort of thought that the dichotomy between those two messages and the normal message you hear from political people about how America is the greatest country in the world was very interesting, and how we thought maybe he was getting away with that sort of thing.
Yeah, Rex, I think you're absolutely right. It is ironic. And also, it points to you might have this sense of patriotism or this sense that America is a wonderful place to be as the potential. America has the potential to be even greater than it is. And it goes back to the comment I made earlier about whether your side's winning or not. And so this dissatisfaction with the way in which the other side, and I use air quotes there, has screwed up versus how America could be the potentially great place that it deserves to be.
Rebecca Dean is Associate Professor of Political Science and Department Chair and Distinguished Teaching Professor at UTA. Also with us is James Riddlesberger, Professor of Political Science at TCU. If you'd like to be part of our conversation about the emotions that are driving your voting decisions this year, we would love to hear from you at 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Spring registration is now open with courses in art, architecture, literature, and languages, as well as professional certificates and test preparation. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
Charles Kane and from Plano. The hate that's being shown out there and being encouraged by the popular vote and things like that, that's what bothers me. That's what I don't want to see. Encouraging racism, encouraging separatism, things like that. It's got to go.
My name is Don Harrison, and I'm from Dallas. The president is in there now. He didn't do a lot of things he said he was going to do, but he did a good talk.
Cynthia McClure, Dallas, Texas. I'm a fiscal conservative and more of a social liberal, and I don't see a candidate at this point that puts those two things together.
My name is Tappan Nag, and I'm from downtown Dallas. We need a leader and not a politician, somebody who understands business and who also has clear foreign policy. I understand, you know, what the threats are, the refugee problem, you know, immigration problem, and the border security problem, gun control, and a whole lot of issues that I'm concerned about. But we need somebody who can address the issues directly, deal with them and solve them.
That was Charles Kane from Plano, Don Harrison, Cynthia McClure, and Tappan Nog from Dallas telling intern Tori Whitley about why they are disillusioned with politicians right now. This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with TCU political science professor James Riddlesberger and Rebecca Dean, who is distinguished teaching professor of political science at UTA. You can join our conversation at 1-800-933-5372. Let us know about your emotions surrounding this election. Let's go to Joel in Dallas. Hi, Joel.
Hey, how's it going?
Great, thank you.
Well, earlier you all were talking about the thinning of the middle class and upward mobility. And my first thought was, I'm 23, and, you know, a lot of my social interaction with my friends is online, you know, through Facebook, through Instagram. And if you don't have a lot of personal wealth, it's easy to kind of feel like you're missing out on a lot of fun that other people are having, because with social media, you only see the highlights from other people's lives. And so I'm wondering, you know, is part of the thinning of the middle class, is that in part due to maybe fiscal irresponsibility on an individual level, you know, spending money that you don't have just to keep up with your friends? Or is there actual economic forces that are keeping people from being able to save wealth?
That's an interesting question. Thanks for your call, Joel.
I think the answer is probably both. The American economy still does afford a lot of opportunity to different people if they have skill sets that are in demand. But having said that, we still see a vastly, rapidly increasing proportion of people in the United States that have less and less of the pie. And I think that I think a lot of people's frustrations is that they see people getting ahead faster than they are and don't think that it's related to how hard they're working.
Right. And I think what Jim just said there at the end is very important. The sense of other people getting stuff that they don't deserve. Whether it's that they, you know, as you say, Joel, bought it on credit and didn't worry about when they would have to pay for it, or whether it's because they fall into a lower socioeconomic status and so they're getting government benefits, right? It's just that sense of, well, of entitlement.
For some people, concern about entitlements is deeply tied to ethnic background, country of origin. People fear that that immigrants to this country are coming in and somehow benefiting from things that native-born American citizens don't receive.
I think there's a great deal of truth to that. And in fact, we have developed in the last 40 years in the United States an entire code language that does relate those to one another. In other words, while for the most part openly racist language has disappeared from the American language, what we see is code language like welfare mothers, code language like immigrants, code language like Arabs or Middle Easterners, all of which kind of appeal to the same kind of prejudices that openly racist language used to appeal to. And so what it does is displace those issues, but it doesn't make them go away.
And not only that, but you also have then a disconnect among the people who are sincerely frightened, who feel as if their livelihood is threatened, who feel as if their way of life is threatened, who sort of the dominant mainstream is no longer one that they recognize, and then who get very angry at the notion that they're being racist for having those feelings.
We have an email here that says, my perception is many people will vote for a candidate that they agree with on one issue while ignoring their temperament and stances on other issues. Is this a greater trend recently? And if so, what has been its effect?
Well, I think that is true, but it's also not true. So the biggest, the most divisive issue we have in the United States over the last 40 years is abortion, of course. And yet, we know from the data from 4 years ago that about a third of the people who voted for Barack Obama had a position closer to Mitt Romney on abortion, and about a third of the people that voted for Mitt Romney had a position on abortion closer to Barack Obama. So certainly, strictly speaking, it isn't the case that all people are single-issue voters. But, of course, there are some single-issue voters, and they tend to be on emotional issues such as gun control, capital punishment, abortion, prayer in school, same-sex marriage, the kinds of issues that can be simple proxies for a very complex world.
With an issue like gun control, each party likes to characterize the position of the other party, which may or may not reflect the actual positions taken by individual candidates. Are voters, do people have the time and the energy to sort of really understand what their person is espousing with regard to something like gun laws and gun control? Or are people sort of taking the shorthand view and maybe not fully understanding?
Well, it depends on who you mean by people, right? Mm-hmm. So if we're talking about the people who are engaged in these early contests, and I'm in New Hampshire, and frankly, folks who are likely to participate in primaries or caucuses in general, then yes, those are the folks who are drilling down into the minutia of their candidates. But if we're talking about, especially in states like Texas that have open primaries where folks can cross over vote from the other party, and then, of course, in the general election, there is a smaller percentage of that electorate that will be as fully informed.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go now to Blake in Louisville. Hi, Blake.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thank you.
Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to speak on two things. Earlier, we were talking about gun control versus terrorism and how those can emotionally affect voters. I just wanted to point out one thing. In France, in just the past year, there's been more terror casualties than in Obama's entire presidency from mass shootings. So I think that the threat of terrorism is far more prevalent to emotional voters than gun shootings. I think it's something more dangerous that people should be concerned about, and that's it.
Thanks very much for your call. I appreciate your insight and your input. Anything you all want to touch on, or can we move on to our next caller? We have Anne in Navarro County. Hi, Anne.
Hi, Chris. Thank you for taking my call. I had a question about one of your panelists said early that Donald Trump and Ted Cruz, for that matter, that the message that they are putting forth appeals to a certain type of person. Well, my first question is, if we don't respond to that message, but we have family and friends who do, how do we talk to them? How do we engage them in a dialogue that we can hopefully change their mind? And my second question is, where do we get clear, unbiased information on how our representatives in Congress are doing?
Well, Anne, thank you so much for your questions. And I would point out that for every person who wants information on how to convince people not to vote for Ted Cruz or Donald Trump, there are probably an equal number of people who want information on how to convince their friends and relatives not to vote for Hillary Clinton or Bernie Sanders. But with that stipulation, any thoughts on sparking positive, productive political conversations?
Well, I mean, there's a difference between having a conversation about a reaction to a specific candidate and having a conversation about a policy issue. I think it's very difficult because people are making up their own minds and they're gathering their own information in their own way and very often with their own designer information. And the result of that is they're going to know who they want to vote for, and you're not going to persuade them differently unless they ask you, at which point I think giving them an honest response is helpful. On the other hand, on issues, I think the key is to try to find commonalities and to talk about what we agree about rather than what we disagree about. So if you bring gun control up as an issue, as it's been brought up a couple of times here, everyone in the United States wants less gun violence directed at humans. So instead of talking about whether we want to take people's guns away from them or not, which is really not an issue in the United States, let's have a conversation about what the best strategies we might employ to reduce gun violence.
And I want to speak to Anne's second point about how you get information. You know, there's an unfortunate trend in the United States of the last couple of decades, which is self-selection of news. That is, we look for the news that we think we're already going to agree with. And I tell my students all the time how unfortunate that is and how you need to, it is your civic duty to make friends with someone you think has crazy ideas and that will make you a better informed person. And then toward that end, I would encourage you to seek out media that you think you're going to disagree with. Because then you get a well-rounded sense of what the media landscape is in total.
I send my conservative students to Huffington Post and my liberal students to the Drudge Report and make them spend a week reading the position that they disagree with.
How does that work for them? Do they start with outrage and then move to, sort of a broader way of thinking?
Well, I mean, they think, you're kind of crazy professor trying to make me think differently. But I think it opens eyes. It does open eyes because it makes people realize that it's not just a different slant on the news. It's, in fact, a different way of thinking about what the issues of the United States are. I've said for years that the biggest difference between politics now and politics in the 1950s is that we at least all listened to the same news in the 1950s, and therefore we could debate what the positions were on the issues we all understood to be the major issues. Now, because we have our own designer news, we don't even agree on what the major issues are, and therefore having a conversation about that becomes very difficult.
Yeah, I 100% agree.
Thinking about the students that you work with, is there a candidate this year who's polling anywhere near at the level that would mean that he or she could become president that is exciting to students?
Well, they in many ways mirror the trend that I talked about a minute ago in terms of fractionalization. I mean, I've got my Bernie Sanders students. I've got my Ted Cruz students. Not so many of the Donald Trump folks who've embraced him totally. They find him interesting and sort of, subject to understand. But here's the thing. They might be interested in these candidates, but not to the level of go out and canvass for them, not to the level of the kind of deep engagement beyond voting.
Yeah. 8 years ago was the only time in my career that I saw the level of enthusiasm about candidates that you hear from, the Kennedy era and before. People were excited. College age students were excited about Barack Obama. That transcended political party. Even many of my young Republican students thought Barack Obama was an exciting candidate because he was young and different. And we don't have anything kind of like that this year.
Does that is that a bad sign for the engagement of this generation of maybe first-time voters, first- or second-time voters, that there's nobody right now that seems to light their fire?
Young voters are notoriously the worst turnout voters, and they don't typically engage nearly as much as they used to. Even in conversations about politics, I think politics is kind of something that students are not as likely to talk about in their daily conversations as they used to. And that obviously has impacts on turnout and impacts on levels of information and also impact on how excited they are or not about the choices that they have.
And then circling back to this election, that's the problem that Donald Trump is going to have in terms of turnout as well as Bernie Sanders.
All right. We have been speaking this hour with Rebecca Dean, who's Associate Professor of Political Science and Department Chair and Distinguished Teaching Professor at UTA. James Riddlesberger is Professor of Political Science at TCU. I want to thank you both so much for being with us today.
Well, thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer with help on the phones today from Alex Smith. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. I'm on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. The show's email address is think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.